I'm Tom Gentry, and this is Men Who Talk. It's brought to you by Begin Again Institute, a two-week intensive program for men with intimacy disorders in Boulder, Colorado, where my friend and co-host Ed Tilton is the chief operations officer. Ed and I wanted to have a series of conversations on some of the barriers we see that prevent men from living more authentic lives. We want to underscore the fact that healthy men do talk. We want to help men who often do struggle with intimacy be more true to themselves. And we want to help people who love men maybe understand them a little bit better. So please listen in, subscribe to the show, share this conversation with someone you love, and enjoy Men Who Talk. It's my friend Ed Tilton, who is the Chief Operations Officer at the Begin Again Institute in Boulder, Colorado, which is a two-week-long intensive for men with intimacy disorders, pornography addiction, sex addiction. Ed can tell you a lot more about that, but we've started having this series of eight discussions on men and intimacy. And we have a set of topics. This week, we're talking about toxic masculinity, which Ed knows is, I don't know if I'd say it's one of my favorite things to talk about. I feel like it's something that we need to talk about. It's something that's misunderstood, and it's something that it irritates me a lot of times to see how frequently guys seem to conflate toxic masculinity with masculinity itself. And one of the things I thought I'd do to kind of something timely to sort of begin the discussion. So as this war in Ukraine began, I don't know, what's it been, a couple weeks ago now, a couple days after it started, I started seeing memes on Instagram with pictures of Ukrainian soldiers, and one in particular said, "All of a sudden, masculinity isn't toxic anymore." And, you know, implying that, you know, when we need guys to be masculine, it's okay for them to be masculine. But, you know, when we don't, it's toxic, which, again, you know, back to my point, how these things are conflated. And the more I thought about it, I was thinking about this conversation this morning. And, you know, if you look at that conflict, there really is a good example of both in it. When you look at Putin, you see toxic masculinity. And when you see Zelensky, you see healthier masculinity. You know, one of them's fighting for power. There's probably a ton of ego in it. Control, you know, it's destructive. It's not healthy. And then you have Zelensky, who is the protector, which to me is a lot about, you know, the beneficent sort of protective energy is what good masculinity is about, I think. So I don't know. I thought that'd be a good place to start the discussion today. Any thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, I think I really like how you're framing the conversation, which is, you know, let's first define, you know, what is masculinity, you know, and instead of just, because I think one of the things that can happen is there are things that are either masculine, neither masculine or feminine, and they're just destructive. And I think oftentimes we can associate destructive behaviors with the person that's doing it and saying these two things match up. Therefore, this is toxic masculinity. And And I think you're calling into some key pieces, which is, you know, looking at the idea of protection and, you know, community versus, you know, destruction and ego driven. And, you know, how does an exertion of control play a role in relationships? You know, when you, and again, as an American living in America, I don't know how much access we have to accurate depictions of, you know, of both sides, but at least from what's being portrayed over here, you know, the exertion of control that Zelensky's portraying is really, you know, being able to control emotions and understanding of the necessary things that happen or the necessary things that are playing out and how he's going to be able to protect his community. Hmm. And what I've seen interestingly is it seems like there's the exact opposite of that with Russia and Putin, you know, that there are people in Moscow that are saying this actually isn't what we want.
Hmm.
And Putin's like, yeah, well, I mean, nobody knows what Putin's actually saying, but what his actions are showing are power and control is being exerted despite people's, you know, voice to stop.
Mm-hmm. A lot of posturing going on too. A lot of threats, right?
Exactly.
And, you know, which are coming from a place of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is also like sort of an integral part of this toxic masculinity conversation. You know, to me, I associate that with insecurity.
Yeah. Well, and I just listened to this podcast about kind of some of the stuff that happened right around when Putin came to power. So I'm going to say 93, 94, and some of these bombings that happened that a number of people are saying he was behind it, you know, that, you know, he was in a position that he was able to kind of exert this power and control to have, you know, these five or six bombs go off in civilian settings to kind of create a scenario that he rose to power. Because 93, 94, nobody really knew who Putin was.
Right.
He was portrayed in a light that I think, can, you know, a lot of times masculinity can be oddly associated with, which is, you know, he wasn't seen as someone who could be trustworthy or competent in his role because he's short. Mm-hmm. And they interviewed people and they said, well, no, you can't trust him. He's short. Look at how tiny he is. But, you know, leveraging fear and, you know, basically power and control, you know, was able to start the Crimean War. You know, and so now it seems as though much of his perspective of what it means to stay in power is associated with exerting a certain level of control and specifically with the narrative.
Mm. Intimidation.
Mm-hmm. And what's been interesting is some of the conversations that people have had as it relates to a secondary narrative that isn't dependent upon state news in Russia. Mm. And that secondary narrative is with the younger population that has access to alternative media sources.
Mm-hmm.
But all that to be said, kind of dialing back to toxic masculinity, you know, toxicity is oftentimes recognized when a healthier form is presented.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're just to stick with Putin for a little while, I believe Putin's understanding of power and control and fear and manipulation is understood to be in the best interest of the people of Russia, as long as Russia does not have a healthier alternative or perspective that, that contradicts that narrative. You know, once all of a sudden, you know, America and Great Britain and most of Europe and all these other countries start saying, you know, what you're doing is so out of line, we're actually going to stop McDonald's and stop Coca-Cola and stop Apple products. And, you know, in a weird kind of way, it's modeling on a macro scale, you know, setting healthy boundaries and not in a way of punishment, but in a way of like preserving an interest or preserving your mental health.
Right.
You know, these are, you know, Fortune 50 companies that are saying, we actually can't do business if this is the way that you're going to behave.
Right. In the interest of the greater good.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is another sort of hallmark of healthy men, mm-hmm. is that there's a sense of responsibility towards your community. Right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's a common theme that you and I have talked about over the last couple of weeks now, is that healthy masculinity, healthy identity in general, is rooted in connection and community. You know, that there has to be a place of, you know, where an ego can be checked, or when where ideas can be refined and where goals can be, you know, better understood. Is that all happens in community.
Hmm.
You know, otherwise it's either number one, a daydream, you know, because we're not sharing it with anybody. You know, or two, oftentimes it's just poorly executed.
Hmm.
You know, I very, very rarely do I ever see a self-made man in an overall image of being confident in who they are without having people around them that help them get there.
Right.
You know, and I think that the really good ones also do that for others as well.
Hmm.
You know, the really good ones understand this a perspective that I believe to be true, which is that you can't be of service if you're idolized.
Hmm.
You know, and I think that's part of healthy masculinity, is being able to know that I can be a protector, and I also can ask for protection. That the two are not in conflict with each other. Asking for help and receiving help, it's not a debt. It's not a debit and credit system.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that really frustrates me about our culture, is that, and we've talked about this in the other rooms a little bit, how everything just kind of gets dumbed down and we don't consider the nuances of things. You know, to be a healthy, balanced man is to understand your limitations and recognize that I can't do everything. I need help mm-hmm. with some things. And it's okay to get help if I'm not living in service to my ego.
Right.
But if I am, then I need to take credit for everything. So then getting help becomes a threat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea of needing help feels threatening. And back to the insecurity thing. It's pretending I can do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And You know, it's this whole thing about masculinity versus toxic masculinity. You know, it's like a lot of things in our culture where everything is so polarized. Politics is the best example. You know, there doesn't seem to be, like there was when I was a kid, this sort of global understanding that we all have our own convictions and, you know, I might disagree with you and yours, but it doesn't make you any less of a human being. And it definitely doesn't make you a villain.
Right.
Right. And it's, just like with this, you know, I don't know, there may be some people out there who think masculinity in general is toxic, but I don't think anybody is really advocating for there to be no more men.
No.
I think if anything, women want us to be more masculine and from an emotional standpoint anyway, more grounded, stand in our power, be decisive, all those kinds of things. But to me, you know, all this goes back to emotions and how we handle our emotions. And I think it's tied in very much with this tendency in our society for men to be emotionally detached and numb. You know, what do you call it? Not emotionally illiterate, but emotionally dyslexic.
Yeah.
And to me, that's where I think that in and of itself, that phenomenon that, you know, men aren't supposed to experience emotions is in and of itself emasculating. I think that's what's emasculating, if we really get down to it, you know, because it's a setup, because you're telling me I shouldn't mourn, I shouldn't shed tears, I shouldn't be sad, I shouldn't, you know, and I mean, that's life.
Right.
You know, of course I'm going to experience emotions, but then, you know, our society tells us there's something wrong with us if we do. So then as men, we go through life not wanting to talk about it, wanting to pretend it's not happening because it's unacceptable. And we're pretending and we're insecure. And then, and then that's where the chest pounding, the posturing, the, you know, the extreme sort of expressions of dominance, violence, those things, you know, there are guys out there that, well, if I, you know, if that's the only, thing that clearly indicates to me that I'm masculine, which is, you know, something it's unacceptable for me to not be, and I don't feel masculine enough, then I'm gonna, you know, I'm gonna do stupid things to try to feel like a man. I think that's a lot about of what this is all about, feeling like a man or not feeling like a man.
I think you're exactly right. And I think it's the more we can have conversations to say emotions are part of they're part of the human condition. Like it's a package deal. If you are a human, you're going to experience emotions, you know, and ideally you live in a community and you have a connection with people, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that are teaching you to recognize emotions, understand emotions, not be overwhelmed, and still have access to your authentic self. And ultimately it's about this piece of like, there's a really easy access to fake it till you make it by engaging anger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and engaging anger as a way to numb, to distance, to, you know, to place people in roles. And I think this is one of the connections that you're making is like, when we start placing people in roles and labels that are very, air quotes here, but like simple, you know, if my anger is telling me that like, I'm the victim and you're the perpetrator, like that's a very easy way to justify a ruthless reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you hit the nail on the head of like, masculinity is about understanding where I should and shouldn't go, you know, with emotions, with behaviors, with expectations, with manipulations. Just because I can doesn't mean I should. But that also means that, you know, we have to have connection. Because if it goes unchecked, you end up with a tyrant.
Yeah.
And a lot of the guys that come to Begin Again have been terrorizing a lot of people in their life.
Hmm.
You know.
Is there a little girl in the background right now?
There is. That's the little pixie known as Sydney.
Okay.
She made me strawberry milk.
Oh, and, wow.
So as we are
drinking pink stuff, huh?
Drinking the pink stuff as we're talking about healthy masculinity.
Yeah.
I can't make this up.
Breaking barriers right now.
My daughter who's 7 came down in a tutu with pink milk and is like, "I made this for you, Dad." So, you know, for me, masculinity and the modeling of the relationship that I have with her is that I am somebody who can be safe,
mm-hmm.
and I can be open and accepting, and that part of the safety on her end means that I can provide and protect for her.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one thing that I feel like sooner or later we're going to have to talk about in this series of discussions is the patriarchy.
Mm.
And I figured maybe this week would be a good time to touch on that. And what about it is problematic? And from my point of view, you know, the idea of living in a culture where we collectively decide that in general, men are going to sort of take the lead.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that. You know, I know there are a lot of people out there who have religious convictions about it. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with the concept. Or that, you know, we should throw it all away necessarily. To me, what's problematic about it isn't that men are in positions to lead. It's that men are in positions to lead who don't deserve.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are men. Not because they've earned it, but because they are men. You know, the privilege aspect of it.
Yeah.
And I think how it relates to this is that if I have a job that I and a woman interviewed for, and we both know she's the much better candidate,
mm-hmm.
she's the real leader between the two of mm-hmm. us, the natural leader. Yet I got the job because I'm the guy.
Mm-hmm.
How do I feel about myself?
Yeah.
I feel like a fraud deep down. And I might not be conscious of it. And I might try to convince myself I deserve it because I'm a man.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's all a crock. You know, that's not real. So to me, that's how it sort of fits in to this. It goes back to the insecurity thing. It's not that men are chosen over women. It's that men are chosen over women who don't deserve it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That to me is what's wrong with it. If the guy is a great leader, fantastic. Let him, mm-hmm. you know, let him be the leader. If he's the best candidate, but it's unfair.
Right.
It's just unfair.
And I think part of it too is, you know, we have a responsibility as men to check our egos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to say, and this is, you know, this is one of the things that I'm very lucky and fortunate to have as a model of a different way of doing things with my boss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she actually will encourage us to challenge ideas on things that are new or innovative as a way of saying, like, I might have missed something. You know, what am I missing here? Poke holes in my idea. Like, let's make sure before we initiate something that it's, you know, tested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where it's very clear with her leadership style that the mission and passion is the focus.
Right.
That ego's the first thing to leave the room. And that makes it a lot easier to be able to, you know, to collaborate mm-hmm. and have a better product. You know, and I've also worked with other male leaders where it's like, man, I've got stuff to tell you. I just don't think that, you know, and you and I have had these talks where it's like, I can tell so-and-so this, but he's just not going to be open to it.
Right.
And when I do, it's very clear that his ego is bruised and now he's going to exert some form of revenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wrath. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I've had male supervisors who were like your boss.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had female supervisors who were, I had one boss who, you know, just no matter what, would never, ever admit she made a mistake.
Right.
Never admit that she wasn't right. Anything other than right. And mm-hmm. what was expected in that little culture was to pretend.
Right.
To pretend that, you know, it was like a clear understanding. We all know she's wrong,
mm-hmm.
but we don't say it. Because if you say it, it's over. Like, you lose your job.
Yeah, you got to support the ego.
Right.
It's like, hey, we got to make sure this narrative stays intact.
Right.
You know, I mean, I completely agree, and I think it's well said of bad leaders are not monopolized by one specific gender or the other.
Right.
You know.
Nor is toxicity.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think oftentimes toxicity, you know, manifests when there are these big components of, like, missing a community or being of service or, you know, being willing to try something new and not be great at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I look at my boss, Christy, and, you know, Christy didn't one day wake up and go, hey, I think I should, like, have people challenge me on ideas that I have. Like, that seems like a fun Tuesday.
Right.
Like, no, that's terrifying. you know, you're the CEO of a company and you're going to come in and say, I've got this idea. What am I missing? And to your point, that's where falsities thrive, is by not acknowledging that this could in fact be flawed. You know, and also, like, you have to have an immense amount of trust and also understanding of the greater purpose to be able to do that.
Mm. Well, and ego strength, you know?
I can almost guarantee, no such thing as a sure thing, but I can almost guarantee that, like, Putin's not asking the general public, like, we're on the right track, right, guys? Poke holes in this idea.
Right. No, they're arresting people who disagree.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and I think if we are, you know, I look at my daughter's generation, I look at, you know, some of the younger generations, and I think, man, if we're going to be successful as a civilization, this is something that we have to continue to work to chip away at.
Hmm.
Of dismantling the patriarchy and that belief that because somebody is born to look a certain way, they are born in a leadership position, or if they're in a leadership position, that leadership should look like this, or that we should condition people to engage in relationships like that. And, you know, these are some of the things that at Begin Again Institute, we are actively engaging with men to help dismantle that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bringing up pieces of, like, this, you know, there's a diagram out there. It's called the Duluth Power and Control Wheel. And it really kind of embodies a lot of ideology of the patriarchy. You know, and that is, it talks about exertion of, like, physical power in terms of, like, abuse, and emotional power, you know, in terms of gaslighting and those types of manipulation pieces. But then it also touches on other aspects as well, like, you know, financial manipulation, you know, or financial abuse, you know, of hey, we agreed to a particular relationship where maybe you made the money and I took care of the house, but now you're not allowing me to have access to the finances to make decisions.
Right.
Or using children as a point of leverage.
Hmm.
You know, using family and friends against you. You know, and these are all these pieces of, like, if you're engaging in these behaviors, you're in toxicity.
Hmm.
You know, and so it's one of these things where, you know, when we work with our guys, we say, you know, these are things that if this exists in a relationship, you're not going to experience the happiness and resolve that you could.
Hmm. Well, and I think the word relationship is really important here, because that's how this shows up.
Mm-hmm.
It shows up in relationships. Healthy masculinity, toxic masculinity. That's where we see it demonstrated, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why it matters. So we've covered a lot of stuff. So I've sort of said what my sort of Tom's definition of toxic masculinity is. How would you describe toxic masculinity? What does that term mean to you?
I would say, in a succinct manner, toxic masculinity is the expression of a false assumption of how power and control can be utilized to achieve a relationship.
Hmm.
you know, and I'm going to say this, but you wrote it, but it's this idea of toxic masculinity is to monopoly money.
Okay.
You say it. It was better when you said it.
Masculinity is to toxic masculinity is what money is to monopoly money.
Yeah.
One's real and one's fake. I think that's really what it boils down to.
I agree.
Because the whole idea of toxic masculinity is, you know, it's about a false counterfeit expression of masculinity. I'm faking it dramatically because I'm not feeling it authentically.
And the pieces that I have access to evoke fear in others will generate a perceived compliance or relationship. If you don't believe me, I'll get big, I'll get mean, I'll exert, you know, sanctions or consequences or whatever, so that you essentially submit, and that submission is perceived as like a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, in validation of I have this power.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and the difference is, you know, in a healthy man, that security, you don't need that feeling of power.
Right.
You know, it's, do I know who I am? To me, mm-hmm. that's the way that I think of it. If I know who I am and I'm not unsure about that, I'm not insecure about that, and I'm comfortable with it, then I don't need to prove anything to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need you to follow me. I don't need you to agree with me. I don't need you to do what I say, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But all those other things are, you know, in a toxic situation, you know, it's an attempt to demonstrate to myself that I am.
Right.
I am, I measure up, right? I measure up as a man. And I think another part of this that you and I've talked about a lot that is important to touch on is the whole idea of rites of passage.
Oh, 100%.
And how we don't really have that in most of our culture. We don't have that ceremonial sort of aspect of yesterday I was a boy, today I'm a man. So there's this blurry line. Like for me, the healthier, more supportive guys in my life would treat me like, okay, you're a man now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm proud of you, that kind of energy. And the more unhealthy figures were like, who do you think you are? You're not a man.
Mm-hmm.
So what's a 20-year-old kid do with that? He doesn't know.
Right.
You don't know. But if we live in a culture where on Tom's 14th birthday, all the men take him out into the woods to do whatever.
Right.
And he sleeps out alone for 2 days, whatever it is. But he leaves as a boy, and everyone in the community treats him like a boy. But he comes back as a man, and everyone treats him as a man. He can own it. It's a clear understanding. He's a man, and he's expected to live out the ideals that come with that, right? Which to me, the big one is, you know, if I'm a boy, I'm self-centered. If I'm a man, I have a sense of responsibility to my community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's acceptable for a boy to be mostly self-involved, right? A child.
Yeah.
But if you're a man, you know, a good man, you want to protect, you want to help, you want to, you know, make things better. It's contributing, serving a role, being of service, really.
Yeah.
And that's, so going back to the ego thing, that's the difference, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think too, it's about where the message is coming from, right? It's so oftentimes a lot of men's indoctrination into what it means to be a man in relationships, or what it means to be a man, you know, in the bedroom, or those types of aspects are given to them in weird and cryptic ways, and, you know, through, you know, smutty magazines, and, you know, now with high speed internet through pornography, that it really starts to warp. And this is some of the stuff that we look at, is like, from a neurobiological lens, how is this shaping how men are seeing relationships? Mm. And on top of that, if men are seeing this, and like you said, if this is the expectation, if the expectation of relationships for men is not a great bar to achieve, faking that bar when we don't hit it because we're not supported in the right ways to make the tough choices of saying no to certain things and saying yes to certain challenges and really kind of living in authenticity, you really start to get off the path pretty quickly when it's like, the bar wasn't great to begin with, but, you know, posturing to meet a smutty bar is only going to bring you farther off track. Hmm. So then you've got this falsity that's rooted in more falsities. Because what's being portrayed in, you know, in those particular aspects aren't real to begin with. So you've got fake on fake.
Well, you know, we have waxed about this for 45 minutes, two guys. And to me, you know, if you're toxic versus if you're not, I mean, how you treat women is another really clear indication of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe it's time we open up the stage. We have some women down below, and maybe ask them, you know, what does it mean to you? How do you see it? How do you experience toxic masculinity?
Mm-hmm.
And what's it feel like, you know? So, you know, it doesn't have to be women. Guys, you can come up too, but we're going to go ahead and open the stage. So please come up. Raise your hand. Up. Mm-hmm. There we got Sean. Hey, man. How you doing?
What's up, Tom? Ed, how's it going? Great conversation. Good.
Thank you. What do you think about all this?
I like the topic. I think more conversations with men need to be had around this type of a topic. Anger, toxicity, masculinity. They're all, I mean, you know, it's such a broad range of differences within one type of, I don't even know what the word I'm looking for. But you get what I'm saying, right?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing that comes to mind is just mixed messages, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, I've talked about in some of the previous weeks, some of these like Instagram accounts that I see that are all about advocating for masculinity is not toxic and traditional manhood and all this stuff. And, you know, there's, this one account that I follow a lot that, you know, the guy spends a lot of time talking about how, you know, the patriarchy needs to, you know, it's the natural order of things and, you know, it's going to destroy the world if we all this, you know, mm-hmm. And, you know, I noticed the other day that he posted something about how, you know, you shouldn't, you know, none of us are, you know, put on this earth, you know, we shouldn't expect anything. We're not deserving of any particular thing like a relationship or a good job. We got to earn it. And it just hit me like, okay, so you're good with the patriarchy where, you know, there's a lot of privilege.
Right.
But you also want to say that we don't deserve things we don't earn. You know, you're talking right. out of both sides of your mouth.
Yeah.
So anyway, thanks for coming up, Sean. Appreciate it. Got my man Ken down there. Love it if some of you ladies raise your hand and come up here. We want to hear what you have to say about this.
You know, the way that I kind of look at this, I have a four-year-old daughter. She's about to be five. And how I gauge my behavior is I look at it, what kind of a guy do I want my daughter to date? When it comes time for her to be in that kind of a category in the years down the road. And that's the kind of guy I need to strive to be every day.
Yeah. Marlon, thanks for coming up.
Hey, I'd love to share because I'm literally picking up my son in like 2 minutes. I'm like almost there. yeah. So my son is 9 and I came into the room when you guys were talking about, like, you know, there's not really like a solid, you know, like rite of passage, just kind of like, you know, some people treat you like a boy. Some people might treat you like a man when you're teenagers or when your voice breaks or whatever. And I totally feel that, like all of it, like, it's just, I don't feel it all the time, but I'm like highly in tune with all the things that could happen, you know, and I can't imagine what it would like to be especially the father of a girl, not just the mother of a girl, but a father of a girl. And like, what are they going to experience, you know, and all that. So I feel you on that. I'm Sean. So, yeah. So just, what do you guys think I should know about like the rite of passage, like any, as my son's mom, like, what can I tell him? Cause he does have my husband as a good father figure, you know, but I'm more like emotionally in touch with him. Zaid, my son, tells me like things about girls that he likes and things like that. You know what I'm saying? I mean, so I have a feeling he'll probably be coming to me about changes or whatever. So just anything that I can do to just be aware of beforehand or going into his, you know, 12, 13 year old self, I'm here for it. So that's what I have right now. Thank you.
Well, there's this author, Robert Bly, who just died a few months ago. He wrote a book called Iron John, where he talks about all this a lot. And he goes into a lot of detail. And one of the things that he talks about is that this isn't, I mean, it has to happen with a man. You know, we need other men, you know, not because women don't care or women aren't capable or anything like that. It's just that we need men, you know, we need men to teach us how to be men. So that requires men who know how to be men to teach us how to be men. But I would read that book, Iron John. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And it goes into history and sort of how we got here, you know, where all this comes from. And, what Robert Bly would tell you is that, you know, when the Industrial Revolution happened, you know, before that, societies were a lot different. you know, and for the most part, boys were with their dads all the time. And then when factories came along and, you know, men started leaving home to earn a living, where that never happened before. It didn't, before that, it didn't happen. And that really, you know, boys not having that presence of male energy, you know, gradually over the centuries has sort of, you know, affected men adversely. So what were you going to say, Ed? You were about to chime in.
Oh, you know, I think that it was partially in connection to the Robert Bly piece and just having, I think there's so much to be said with just spending time, you know, just sitting with guys, you know, and as a mom, I think you can still emulate, you know, the idea of like, there doesn't have to be an intention or a goal of just getting to know you. As we get conditioned, a lot of times this idea of vulnerability takes time, you know, and your son at like 9 is going to start through, if it hasn't happened already, which is kind of this whole thing of like, mom's cool, but she really is embarrassing. And, you know, the walls are going to kind of come up. Friends are going to become more important.
It's began the embarrassing part of it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's heartbreaking a little bit because I'm so cool. Just kidding.
And so part of this is like, you know, spending time to allow for the awkwardness to dissolve, you know, and allowing, you know, him to, you know, spend time with him where understanding like who he's about, like what is he about is really the focus or goal, you know, because in our society, we're so prone to just activities that are just busy for busy, you know, and it's, I mean, I've got a 7-year-old daughter and a 3-year-old son, and it's like, you know, we go to birthday parties, we go to this, we go to that, but like, I really try to spend time with them, just them. And the question I would kind of ask him, and I'd model it off of the idea of like, you know, medieval times and knights, is like, what is his personal code? You know, knights had a code that they lived by, you know, and whether you, there has to be a kingdom that you're a part of, and there has to be a code that you live by. And I think that those could be questions you can ask as mom. It's going to hit differently if dad's asking, because he's going to ask dad, well, what's your code, dad? Like you're a guy, how does this all work? But it's a lot easier to say, like, I stand for respect and honor and protection as a personal code, and saying it out loud is going to make it easier to replicate it and to model it and to kind of call it out. It's a lot easier to tell ourselves in our mind that we do these things, and it's a lot harder to stand for them when nobody knows about them. So that's what I would say.
Okay. You guys both give me a lot of beautiful information. I really, really appreciate it. It all makes sense. And there's things that I do in practice that you guys have mentioned, and things that I can get better at, and things that I'll be taking on. So thank you. I'm going to go in the audience. I'm picking him up now. And he's just like my husband likes quality time together. He's the same way. Like, yeah, like he doesn't like to see me on my headphones. Right. My son, like he's a Pisces. He's highly sensitive and everything like that. So yeah, quality time is in getting to know like who he really is and like the codes. Yeah. Thank you guys. And I'm really happy I caught the room again.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
You're welcome.
So how you feel like we did with this, Ed? You feel like we covered everything we needed to cover with it?
Yeah, I think it was, I mean, I always have so much fun with these.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we got a little bit of aid with, you know, with the Russia-Ukraine piece. And
yeah,
we circled all the way back to, you know, this idea of like, this happens as a result of falsity.
Right.
Which is, I think, the piece of like, if there's a practical and tactical application to any of this, is, you know, when we feel like we're faking or undeserving or unwilling to ask for help or support, we're at risk of bringing toxicity into the relationship.
Hmm.
And if we're going to fight it, we can only fight that toxicity through community.
Well, and so much of this stuff just boils down to being real,
mm-hmm,
about what's going on and not pretending, and, you know, not pretending I don't feel and not pretending I have it all together, and, you know,
mm-hmm,
just being comfortable enough in your own skin to just be who you are, you know, and occupy that space fully.
Yeah.
You know, and we're enough the way we are. This whole idea of measuring up, we've talked, mm-hmm, about this before. It's something that guys are like really sensitive to. It's, mm-hmm, so important to us to measure up for the people we love, mm-hmm, and to measure up to our dads. And, you know, I know what our kids, like,
right.
I mean, it comes up for me a lot with my son, you know, mm-hmm, am I a good dad? Does this decision make me a bad dad? You know what I mean? Like, it's such a deep sort of, tug, you know, it's not a superficial idea. It's like, it goes straight to my core, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who I am as a human being and my value as a human being.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that you're asking that question, I mean, it gives me a lot of hope for the next generation and the next generation.
Well, and I have a lot of hope. I do, you know, we talked about this last week but you think, you know, I know my son, like, the community he's grown up in is really diverse. Like, there's not even a consideration in his mind to describe someone by the color of their skin. Just wouldn't think of it, right?
Right.
That's his culture. That's not what kids his age, at least in this place, do. You know, they don't even think about it that way. Where, I mean, you and I both grew up deep in the Midwest.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's not the most racist part of the country, but it's definitely not like, or it wasn't when I was a kid, it wasn't like what I just described with my son.
No.
I mean, there were lots of stereotypes and categories, and, you know, and I think that's improving. And I think, you know, as adults, we can talk about this, you know, ad nauseum. But kids are going to do what kids do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, the way I look at it is, you know, they're better. They're better than us. I mean, I'm not one of these people who bemoans the following generations. You know, I feel right. Like they're, you know, they're bringing new information and insight to everything. And you know, I guess it really goes to something that my mom taught me as a very little boy that I've always kind of held on to, and that's that children are pure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't have a distorted lens. You know, life hasn't done the number on them that that it's done on so many of us.
Oh, yeah.
We got a hand. We got Ken coming up here. Good to see you, man.
Hey, Ken.
Good to see you guys. I'm sorry, I got in kind of on the tail. I finished my last appointment and checked to see what was going on, and there you were. So I'm glad you're here. But you know what? I was thinking about this and I was sharing with a fellow the other day. And, you know, I look back at the men that were most influential. Actually, the one that was the most influential was my dad's dad. And he's a kind and gentle soul, ran a what we call a country store, you know, a general store, and had run it since back at the Depression, I guess. And I grew up in that store, and I grew up watching him, how much he enjoyed greeting people, meeting people, talking to people, getting to know about people, and listening to people. And he was always kind and generous and, you know, had a great big vegetable garden. And when it came in abundance, and he just shared it. He didn't sell it. He sold it. Gave it away, you know. And my dad grew up in the shadow of that, trying to find his own identity. But my point is that the example that was set for me, you know, my wife, even when we were dating, there's a saying in the South, you know, he's the spitting image of so-and-so. And it's been bastardized, I guess, by the Southerners, but, you know, it's actually the spirit and image. And she described me that way as my, like the shadow of my grandfather, who she knew, you know, and got to see us together and how we just got along like a, you know, like a house of fire. Almost didn't even have to communicate. We just kind of, but I just watched him. He took time with me. I followed him every step he made in the garden behind the tiller, but he talked, you know, he didn't talk at me. Mm-hmm. He talked. And he shared about what was going on, what he was doing. And it just felt like love and accepted and encouraged, you know, to try new things. And it wasn't overly positive. And I mean, you know, in the way that we looked at life, he just kind of, this is the way it is. And while my dad didn't. My dad had maybe what they call the short man syndrome, you know, needed to achieve more. And the way to get approval and acceptance of others was to work hard, earn more money. You got to earn more money than anybody, you know. And he did, and it didn't improve his self-esteem. But I was fortunate enough. I was paying attention when he got sober, and I saw him, and I realized, oh, my God, he's putting all of his eggs in the basket of, you know, if he's number one, if he makes the most money, he's going to feel okay by himself. And I knew, I could see it. I just knew. And put some of that damn, you know, black mold spread over on me. And I got some of that. Mine was more the workaholism. If I do enough, I am enough. I'll be loved and accepted. And it was just really where I just really wanted to be loved and accepted, because I felt like, and I see it now, that encourages, that's the fertilizer, that's the fertile ground for this little seed known as Ken to grow in. And he can grow in any direction he wants to grow if I get a little water, if I get a little fertilizer, you know, go talk to the plants, you know, talk to the seedling as he's growing. I think really that's how our best people come to know and love and accept themselves. And I mean, to me, that's the richest thing we can offer anybody, is to have acceptance of self, love of self, and know that there are going to be troubled times. You know, there's going to be pain. Suffering is optional. And the meaning that I put on it is where my suffering comes from. And but the wisdom to know that whatever it is, I'm going to get through it, you know, with me and my higher power. But that wasn't kind of there for me. It wasn't a touch. My dad got 12 steps when he got sober. I got some of that. And I have just enough of that to utter the words when my little self is really in some doubt. But to me, and I have trouble thinking about men, growing men versus growing women. And I don't know. I kind of look at everybody as the same because we didn't pick what gender we were going to be. As far as I know, I didn't. You know, it just was. And to grow to be the best person that I can be is probably going to be depend on the person that I watch as I'm growing up, the person that that takes the time to talk to me, not talk at me, but just kind of include me in what they're doing as they're going along. And that's still, I look back at the people who spent time fishing, learning how to tie a fishing knot. I watched a great uncle doing that. He didn't put my fingers on it. I just watched him and I listened. And he talked about it, what it would do and how it would do. And then he went about fishing. And it was easy. So that's the way I kind of learned, I guess, for me. But it was always positive. It was always positive until somebody got fearful, somebody was in anger, or somebody was feeling anxious, the teacher. And then it rolled downhill. Then I got afraid. Then I thought, oh, yeah, don't go there. Don't want to go there. And the self-doubt creeps in. So I think that growing up good, healthy adults really is a responsibility, I think, for all people, you know, all adults. And spending time with the children that are in charge of, that we're in charge of or next to or near anytime, anywhere, you know. And I just think that children already know that piece of scripture that says you'll know them by their demonstrations. You can know them. They'll know who they can trust. And they can feel to be, I think, feel safe to explore who they are. And it's okay to ask those questions. So that's may not even be able to tangent your own, but to me, that's what came up in listening to the shares.
Thanks for coming, man. We need men who talk, right?
And I think, Ken, you said it perfectly. Not talk at us, but talk with us. That's important.
Yeah, it goes back to the power thing. You know, it's not about that. Or it shouldn't be. Because the guys in my world who were telling me I wasn't a man, that's what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
It was about them trying to assert some sort of dominance over me. Or maintain it, mm-hmm. You know? Anyway, well, this has been great, man. And so next week, the topic is, why don't men have lasting friendships into adulthood?
Oh, yeah.
And the idea of like intimate friendships where men connect with each other on an emotional level, as opposed to guys who watch football together but never really have a conversation.
Right.
Be a man. Dress for success. Wear the pants in the relationship. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Give the shirt off your back, but don't lose your shirt. Are you really going to wear that shirt? Be a man. Be a ladies' man. Be the man at home. Make a man out of that kid. Sometimes you have to manhandle a situation to show them you're the man. Act like a man. Be the man at the gym. Is that all you can lift? Man up. Whoops. Man down. Be a man. Carry on. Carry your weight. Carry your water. Carry the ball across the goal line. Be a man. Take a chance. Take a risk. Take the job. Take the money. Don't take more than you give. Don't take any crap. Be a man. Be the man at your job. Work like a man. Be successful. Hustle. A hardworking man is a happy man. Never send a boy to do a man's job. Be a man. Take it seriously. Take a joke. Never let him see you sweat. Drink like a man. Smoke like a man. Fight like a man. Be a man. Tough it out. Don't cry. Don't complain. Don't worry. And don't trust doctors. Die like a man.